Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with one of the most well-respected financial editors and journalists of our time, Gretchen Morgenson. Many of you know Gretchen from her Pulitzer Prize-winning work at the New York Times, in which she has written cutting exposés of the corrosive conflicts of interest on Wall Street, as well as the reckless practices that led to the 2008 correction and its aftermath. I'm looking forward to discussing with her how concerned we should still be about the stability of our financial system, what likely lies ahead, and what solutions and safeguards a concerned society should be demanding most at this stage. Gretchen, it's a true honor to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Chris. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, fantastic. You know, to this observer, in 2008, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department scanned the wreckage of their failed policies and regulatory indifference and entered a form of triage. Only able to save one class of patient, they chose the big banks and other well-connected financial institutions and threw another class of patients under the bus. Those other patients represented savers and the prudent, retirees, pension funds, seemingly anybody who was prudent and perhaps knew how to defer gratification, were asked to pay up in the form of negative real interest rates to help get the big banks not only back in the black, but in a position to hand themselves record bonuses. At least, that's how it appeared to me, and continues to appear to me today, and I think I represent a fair proportion of society. How do you see this?
Well, you could not have put it more succinctly, Chris. Honestly, the transfer of wealth that has been created, that has been taken from the saver and from the taxpayer, don't forget, to, quote, mend the financial system or to keep it from falling off the cliff is really extraordinary. When you talk about savers, these are the people, as you point out, that really had nothing to do with the crisis. They were, in fact, doing the right thing, not buying more house than they could afford, putting away money for college educations, etc. But they are the ones who are really paying the price now. And I think that's led to a very angry populace, but also a sense that there are two sets of rules in the country, that one set applies to big and powerful institutions that when they go awry are, rescued quickly. And then there's another set of rules for the rest of us who kind of do what we're asked to do, do what we're supposed to do, and really then become victims of the situation. It's very unfortunate, and I think it's, as you say, corrosive.
Well, you mentioned that there's different sets of financial rules, apparently. I'd like to talk about another set of, apparently, two sets of rules that exist. So as I understand the robo-signing scandal, forged signatures were applied to everything from loan applications to court affidavits. And when I sign those documents, there's a stern little box warning me under there that if I materially represent anything in that document, it's considered fraud and subject to some pretty serious criminal penalties. Yet the recent mortgage agreement with the bank settled for, roughly $25 billion, seemingly removes criminal penalties entirely from the remedy. If a forged signature is not a material misrepresentation, then I don't think anything can be. Is anyone at the top even slightly concerned that both the appearance and even the application of the rule of law are vital components of our social fabric? Is this part of the conversation?
Boy, it sure should be, Chris. You again, really put it perfectly. The idea that forging signatures, that notarizing very important legal documents really improperly in thousands of cases, maybe millions, the idea that that somehow is going to be allowed to go on with just sort of a penalty of some kind or a fine and not prosecuted for, in the criminal courts, I think is it's amazing. It's really counter to what we've all been led to believe was the course of action in such a case. You have many small people, small fry mortgage fraudsters who are in jail, okay? I mean, we're talking about the people who were straw buyers for homes, who, defrauded banks, and they're in jail for a good reason because they perpetrated a fraud. But these banks that whose employees were forging signatures should also have been prosecuted with vigor, and they were not. They were simply allowed to negotiate their way out of trouble and negotiate their way with shareholders' money. You know, they're not paying it out of their own executives' pockets. They're paying it out of the shareholders' pockets. So there really is no accountability here whatsoever, Chris, and I think that's just been a theme that has been very troubling to a lot of people.
Well, you know, Gretchen, one thing that really caught me as well is if you do take a tour back through some of the prior settlements that have been negotiated, often it's found that there's a pattern of what looks like an ironclad agreement, a settlement, it's got money involved, it has certain actions that are agreed to be taken. The banks, in many cases, have been found to just sidestep those or ignore those and have to be resued or taken back to the courts in an attempt to get the remedy finally enforced. So it's not just that we're allowing them to skate around some of it. It almost feels like they feel entitled to skate around every possible piece. Like there's no, I don't know how I would put this, but there's no attending to the spirit or the letter of the law in some cases.
I agree. And, you know, this is all done, as you know, in the kind of framework of protecting the financial system. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering why there have been so few criminal prosecutions of people who were centrally involved in the years leading up to the crisis. And it is really quite an interesting question. But you hear over and over again from those in positions of power, whether they be regulators or prosecutors, you know, we had to protect the financial system. Well, if you're going to do that, that's fine. You know, conduct the triage, as you describe it, during the years or moments when you must. But then you have to exact a price from the people who brought us to the cliff and almost over the edge. You know, you cannot let them get away with this and expect them not to do it again in a few years in an even bigger way.
Well, it's happened again and again, and it seems to be more pervasive than ever. It's almost like if I look back through the history of financial crises, they've just sort of grown increasingly larger and a little bit more abundant. As well, though, when we look all the way back to savings and loan crisis, you know, what was it, 1,900 people, I think, and many of them executives went to prison for their actions then. And today, the number, if it's not zero, it's darn close at the executive level.
Actually, Chris, the numbers are that we found in doing reporting on this very good, I think, comparison, is that there were 1,100 criminal referrals in the S&L crisis, and there were 839 convictions. Mm. And so that is a sizable number, and far, far, far more than we have seen. I mean, I think I can name one senior-level person at a mortgage company who's in jail at the moment, and that is Lee Farkas, who was at Taylor, Bean & Whitaker, which is nobody's idea of a household name company, and it certainly wasn't at the center of the mortgage crisis.
So how is it that this is occurring now? Is this sort of the natural end game that happens when we have a system that begins to take care of its own? Is this just a function of the revolving door between regulatory bodies and the industries that are meant to regulate? How did we get to this point where so little interest and activity is happening in holding people accountable?
You know, I ask this of prosecutors whenever I meet them, and they're as confounded as I am, because I think the mentality among many of these people is that you do want to bring cases, and you do want to have success, and something to show for your years of effort, but it really is, the record is really dismal, and so I think you can only conclude that there has been, again, this sense that we had to save the financial system, and so therefore put off doing anything until it was far too late to collect the material. You know, the statutes of limitations may have run on many of these crimes. Or some prosecutors have suggested to me that during the years leading up to the crisis, the regulators were so inert and inept that they did not even collect the information that's needed to make cases after the fact. So the regulatory failure, it seems, was twofold. You know, it failed to rein in the practices in the years leading up to the crisis, and then, by so doing, it failed in the aftermath by not being able to supply the information necessary to bring cases. it really is an extraordinary situation, and the idea that there's no penalty for these failures is, again, pretty discouraging.
So where does that leave us then? I think you've done one of the most outstanding jobs summarizing the various abuses and excesses that led up to the bursting of the mortgage market and the global economic chaos that resulted. But here we are several years later, and to my assessment, I think that we find many of the root causes have not been adequately, if at all, addressed. In some cases, the fundamentals of the system have only gotten worse. We have more debt today, derivatives are larger, imbalances seem to be there, and transparency is not quite where we were promised it might be. How much more or less secure do you see things being today, given the fact that we've allowed these transgressions not only to transpire, but go unpunished, if I could use that word? What are the concerns we should be aware of here?
Well, I think you're dead on. You know, the resolution to this crisis was supposed to be the Dodd-Frank legislation of 2010, and unfortunately it was, not even close to what was needed to proscribe this kind of thing from happening again. I think that, first of all, Dodd-Frank did absolutely nothing about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It was completely silent on those mortgage companies who were very central to the problems and are, you know, into the taxpayer for $183 billion. So the fact that it was silent on that issue, I think, is very, very important to remember. We don't know, we have no resolution in place, no suggestion of one for either of those companies. The second thing that I think is a big failing of Dodd-Frank is that it did nothing about too-big-to-fail institutions. That's the, you know, powerful, politically interconnected financial institutions that are not allowed to fail when they get into trouble. You know, if it had been me, I would have liked to have seen something that cuts these institutions down to a more manageable size, and yet we did not force that on them at all. In fact, if you take a look at the assets at the top 10 banks in the United States, they are bigger, they're larger than they were before the crisis. So those are two elements that I think have absolutely not been dealt with and that leave us really vulnerable to another episode like this in the future.
I think what you're talking about then is that there is some failure of introspection here at some level to really stand back and ask the hard questions, what went wrong and why. And so at the macroeconomic level, I can summarize, and I have summarized, our global economic plight in just three words: too much debt. It was a very long, multi-decade sort of expansion of credit, far faster than the underlying economy. As any family knows, when you take on debt faster than your income rises, sooner or later, you get in trouble. At the moment, debt servicing is manageable for the U.S., but only barely, and that's with interest rates at multi-generational lows. However, when we include entitlement obligations, not even a zero rate of interest could balance the books. So we therefore find our options, you know, if we peer into this, are limited to some form of default or printing. Do you come to the same conclusion? And how do you see our situation playing out in the U.S. given what's happening politically?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that this was a crisis built on debt. And for that very reason, it's taking us way longer to get out of it than, say, a crisis built on, you know, internet stocks that were, you know, basically equities that people had made bets on. You know, that was a large devastation of wealth when the internet bubble burst, but it was by no means as devastating as this debt crisis because, you know, as you know, the assets shrink in value, but the debt that you took out to carry them does not. And this is where you have people living in homes that are underwater, that are worth less than the mortgage outstanding on them, people with drowning in college education debt. So yes, we are in a really bad situation, and with very slow income growth or slow job growth, you see how difficult it is to dig out. So I think that's why we are in this long, slow march out of the mess. And it's very, very difficult to see how it's going to change anytime soon.
So in your recent book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon, that was co-written with Joshua Rosner, you wrote that you felt compelled to write this book because we are angry that the American economy was almost wrecked by a crowd of self-interested, politically influential, and arrogant people who have not been held accountable for their actions. And that obviously stands true today. Of course, I think MF Global sort of puts that into sharper relief than ever. And at the same time, there are these structural issues which are caused by too much debt, which are really a lot of people are very concerned about, but we don't know how to get traction on these because we're not actually having the discussion at the what I'll call the national debate level yet. It's certainly happening very vigorously in books, between individuals, on the internet, on blogs. It's happening all over the place, but kind of at the margins. What will it take to push this to the center? Does this require a crisis, or can we get there on our own terms?
You know, Chris, I'm shocked that it hasn't led to a really honest dialogue already, this crisis, because it was so large and so devastating, and it hurt so many people, that I thought, wow, this is really it. This is going to force the issue to be brought into the open, to be discussed, you know, intelligently, and to be resolved. And it just hasn't been. So, I mean, I lay it at the feet of Washington because I think they were crucially involved in the crisis in the years leading up to it. And so there is a reason why they don't want to deal with it. There's a reason why they don't want vigorous investigations, because it could very well lead back to an understanding that they were major contributors to the crisis. So you have this weird disconnect where the populace at large, you know, many people are angry and concerned and discussing and dialoguing and, as you say, on the internet and in coffee shops, but Washington is, it just rings hollow for them. They just don't want to address it. And so this is the failure I spoke of earlier about how no dealing with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, no resolution for the big banks that are too big to fail. So it's a deep, I think, dysfunction in Washington that is maybe a result of their understanding of how deeply involved they were in laying the groundwork for the crisis.
So it would be fair then for a prudent adult who's fairly rational to peer into the system, see its dysfunction, understand some of the risks that are there unaddressed, maybe even mounting in some cases, and come to the conclusion that waiting for Washington to see the light and ride to the rescue is maybe not the most dominant strategy in their lives?
Well, I think they're going to be waiting a long time. I just don't see it happening. I don't see it. Even in an election year, we're not having these important conversations. And so, as you said, you know, what is it going to take? Well, I was shocked that a crisis of this size did not generate that discussion already.
So here we are. What would you advise, say, individual citizens to do in this particular landscape? Do you have any particular views on how investing, or just let's say return of capital rather than return on? How does one navigate this landscape?
You know, it's very difficult for people to not go out on the risk perspective, on the risk horizon, to gain the kind of income that they're used to getting. Just even on, you know, treasury securities, for that matter, relatively risk-free. So it's a really excruciatingly difficult time for people, especially those living on fixed incomes, but also those who are saving for retirement. You know, again, I would just say do not take risks, even though the Federal Reserve is essentially encouraging you to do so. We know how that can end. It can end badly, and so I think that is a pursuit that must be maintained, be safe, not sorry. But also, you know, pay down debt to the degree that you can, because that would protect people from being hurt and being put in a situation where they really are in a vise and can't get out.
I think that's very sage advice, and it's advice that I've been promoting myself for a while. This is all the time we have today. I would encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Reckless Endangerment, because knowing where we are and how our current system is dysfunctional is an important edge, and because it's a very good read. Gretchen, thank you for your time and insights today.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed myself.
Pleasure was mine.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartenson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.